I'm opening.
We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another Anatomy of a Movie. This week's dissection is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the eighth installment in the storied franchise. I'm John Comerford. I'm joined in the studio by...
Hi, guys. This is Sarah Stratton.
Hello, bright eyes. This is Dimitri.
And in the booth, joining us will be Phil Svitek.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, for those of you who don't know, Dimitri and I, we powered through all seven in a Planet of the Apes special last week, so definitely check that out if you're getting caught up like Sarah, perhaps.
Yes, and let's
talk
about that real quick.
I'm not even getting caught up. I was just introduced. I mean, I feel like getting caught up would mean that I actually had some knowledge of the other ones, but unlike the folks around me, I don't.
Well, that's why Art's Planet of the Apes special from last week would be a perfect start.
All right. Should I watch the movies or watch your special first?
You should watch the special before you watch the movie. That might have helped. But that's it. But so,
it would have helped. Yeah.
But so, wow, can you take that down a little? Sarah's just obviously admitting... that she has never seen any of the, except for this one, of course.
This was my intro. Uh-huh.
But you had heard of it, right? You had known of it?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I definitely, I know it's, an iconic franchise, mm-hmm. and that it's been around forever, and, I mean, there was so much publicity for this movie, right. So I was really drawn in. And I thought it was fantastic. I didn't feel lost, mm-hmm. so...
So the credit sequence with the whole... story about how the simian virus, how it killed everybody, that was enough for you? You didn't need to know anything about that? Okay.
I mean, I think that there's been enough apocalyptic and science mm-hmm. stories that you can kind of piece together what something happened. That's happened. So, I might be a little off, but in my opinion,
well, we know
it's
that,
like
but it has nothing
humans,
to do
with- very funny. It's like sweet. Humans obviously created some sort of virus and it went into these apes, and then some people were not immune to the virus and some people were, and mm-hmm. a lot of people died, and human races mm-hmm. dwindled down, and now they're fighting over the power of the planet. And
here's
so
the good
James
news
Franco shows up you didn't what
because it was I remember that being on the screen, and obviously it's that small cameo mm-hmm. shot then a shot, and I was like, is that James Franco? And I was like, no, it's not James Franco. And I was like, wait, it's James Franco. And you just assume, you're like, oh, he was in obviously another mm-hmm. film. Or they called him, because I feel like James Franco is pretty much like, I'll do it.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you need me to do? Just stand there for 2 seconds? Okay. So
Phil,
I
you
just
kind of
brushed
that
one aside.
Well, I was just going to say this. I think a lot of, from kind of what I've gathered, a lot of females are in the same kind of boat. Mm-hmm. But it's a testament to the movie that, so many people saw the first one or in this kind of reinstallment and loved it. And now with the second one, so many people do want to see it, and they're marketing it 100% correctly that, people just want to go see it regardless of whether or not they saw the old ones.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then as she's saying, the nice part is you don't really need to be introduced to the rest of the world. It's nice, but you don't need it.
The demographics bear that out because, 58% of those who went were males. So not many females. Well, obviously many, but not as many.
Yeah, well, and to shamelessly promote again, mm-hmm. Phil and I did talk about that last week when we were going through Planet of the Apes, and it doesn't surprise me, as a boy growing up in the, mm-hmm. Late 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Planet
yeah, this
of
would and, not have been my take.
This
would
so why is it that you wouldn't want to see a movie like this?
Oh my gosh, you guys are...
Yes, of course.
They're referring to the fact that I said that I don't like monkeys all that much. They're scary. I've seen them in the wild. They steal your stuff. And they're kind of aggressive. And, you have to be very careful around mm-hmm. them.
Yeah, because they're not upset that of all the animal testing we've done to them, mm-hmm. that has nothing to do with it, perhaps.
No. That's not
which
what
is why
saying.
I love this movie for that fact of
I'm just saying that as a young girl when I was little and playing with my Barbies, it probably didn't sound that appealing to go watch a movie about how all the monkeys were going to take over the world. I'm sorry, all the apes were going to take over the world, and we were all going to die. that didn't really sound great.
But even like the James Franco movie didn't wasn't enough to have you go to the theater.
I remember coming out and just being kind of like, oh, maybe I'll see it, mm-hmm. and then I didn't really feel completely compelled to see it. This one,
what now? Okay, had you not been doing this, would you have gone to see it? Do you think?
I think so.
You do?
Yeah. Just because, first of all, I thought that the advertisements were kind of blinding. Mm-hmm. I saw them so much, and it was one of the only trailers that was actually sticking out to me after I saw other movies. Like, people would ask me, like, oh, what's coming out? I was like, oh, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Like, they were pushing it. On top of that, I'm a huge Andy fan. I love him. Lord of the Rings, Gollum, everything. Master.
Oh, I'm sorry, he was in the first one.
You said Indy.
Andy.
For okay. Yeah, I thought you said, at first, you said Indy. You said Indy fan.
Did I say? Well, I'm also an
huge
Andy
fan. Huge Andy Serkis fan. Okay.
But I'm an Andy and an Indy fan. But so I was really excited to see it, and I knew he'd been putting a lot of work into this, and I heard a lot about the technology, and I think all of that fired really well on this film. So I'm overall very happy. I don't know if it's going to push me to go back and actually watch all the other ones, because I think one of the greatest things about this film is how amazing they do the animation of all of the apes, and I think that was so compelling and amazing. It would kind of be harder for me to go back because I'd be looking for that, because that's what really attached me to this movie.
It is kind of fascinating because you look at the original, the 68 one. I have to say, what they were able to accomplish in terms of emotion from those actors with all that. No technology. It's all technology in terms of makeup, but no, digital.
But it's the same thing. It's like, if you ever try, like, I grew up with Star Wars.
Sure.
But if you try and bring people who've only watched the more recently filmed Star Wars to the original, a lot of them are like, what? They don't realize how amazing it was. Yes.
No. I don't know anybody who would watch episodes 1-3 first and then go and then say that.
No. I'm saying
the original
trilogy was better. No, I'm saying people that weren't introduced to it. Like, weren't introduced to the original trilogy right away.
And if you were going to tell me that somebody would literally not say that Empire Strikes Back was a better movie than any one of the first
three. I think what she's saying is for those people who are used to digital filming, not those movies, other movies.
Go back and watch it, a lot of them aren't as drawn in, aren't as captivated.
I don't know.
That's my experience with introducing people to those films.
I don't think Star Wars is a good example.
But I totally can understand that, because you can see the technology and how much it's grown, and that may throw
versus
you.
If
you might still love the story.
Grown up loving it, and that's what you're introduced to first. Right. Like, you're so in that world that you're not expecting an Avatar technology.
Before we get off the road on Star Wars,
but the original Planet of the Apes of Charlton Heston, I think holds up to this.
It does
equally as well. And when we talk again, this is something we did talk about last week. Sure. Was that, you know, Roddy McDowall and
Kim Hunter
are greatly underappreciated for what they did.
Yeah.
And it really gives credence to what it is to act under makeup.
Oh, my God.
And at that time, you know, what's sad is there was no makeup category for the Oscars. So it got completely overlooked, but yet their performances. And Roddy McDowall, who was pretty much in every one of the Apes movies up until Battle, I believe, was the last one. I mean, he was amazing, no matter which character he played. And that to me is acting. I'm not going to take away from Andy Serkis. I thought we would get more into that a little bit later, as pros and cons with technology and whether or not Academy Awards and all that stuff. But I still think that the original Planet of the Apes of Charlton Heston, its heft and weight, as far as thematically and even performance-wise, I think it was, you know, I don't think it can still compare. And I think what Matt Reeves did a fantastic job in Dawn. I enjoyed Dawn more than I enjoyed Rise. I thought emotionally there was more emotional heft that I was expecting from Rise, which it sort of had that, the Rise of the Planet of the Apes. This one was much more. I found myself way more drawn in. And you know that you're vested into a movie when you start getting emotional about, you know, whether it's the apes and the humans and but when a special effect, when you look above and beyond the special effects, you realize that you've got a good movie on your hands, because, you know, throughout history, of movies, when the original King Kong falls off the Empire State Building, like when you when
the
you
original,
feel bad,
which original are you talking about?
Not De La, Dino De Laurentiis,
the 39 version,
the black and white Fay Wray. You know, when that Ray Harryhausen-ish stop motion King Kong falls off the Empire State Building, you feel bad. You
people
cried, and but you know that you've. That's it. The movie worked. There's a reason why people fell in love with E.T. And they laughed at Mac and Me. There's a reason why you think Gizmo is cute and fuzzy and warm in the Gremlins. And there's a reason why Ghoulies, you know, gets laughed at. You know, it's all about in which the character in which you lend these special effects. It's why Yoda is so beloved, even though he was a puppet, but it's the way that he's created. It's the way that he's worked. And the same works in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, even though, you know, it's motion capture and it's what Andy Serkis does, but it's also what the special effects are able to do. And when it draws you in, that means that it's above and beyond just the special effect. It's a story. You get drawn in, and it's all about the acting. It's about the performance. It's about the script. And in Dawn, I did find myself, I got drawn in, and I was like, okay, the movie works. It drew me in more so than Rise did. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting more of that out of the first one. So, you know, I was very pleasantly surprised by what Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I thought it was a really good movie and really showed off Matt Reeves' directing capabilities. I've been a fan of since day one and with him. And, you know, he did a solid, solid job. And again, we talk about the collaboration. And I think everything pretty much fired in all cylinders. We had great editing, good cinematography, you know, very good makeup. And then we had the performances to match. And, you know, it brings you in for a science fiction. And it's a very good science fiction story.
Phil.
Captures the legacy.
Phil, where were you on all the thing?
I mean, was it better? I thought the first, I don't know, I hate comparing this to Rise just because it is so different for me, having seen both. I think this one builds upon what Rise did. What I thought the continuation of being able to tell a story visually was fantastic. You know, and this was the natural progression we got. You know, at first, we're focused on Caesar in Rise, and then a few more apes kind of come into his life, and he's, you know, takes control of them. But now seeing a whole civilization where he's in charge, and to me, well, my favorite aspect was all the shots of him, like, really in power.
Yeah, I like,
you know, and kind of just, I don't want to say from a primitive standpoint of how that kind of, you know, how you establish, you know, what a leader looks like, but I thought that worked really well in his, you know, his hand gestures. And I went through his pain of, like, you know, he really wanted to help the humans and see this, but you could see where, you know, he also had to struggle because it's so easy for all the apes to just be like, okay, you're a poor leader. You know, let's fight.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, what about the speaking of the trailer, since that's what you talked about, it was a wonderful bait and switch because in the trailer, it was very heavy on that scene of Caesar up in the tree in the war paint with his hand up and then saying, go. And then the trailer leads you to believe
that he's leading the fight.
He's leading the big fight against humans, but the movie opens up in his eyes. It's
ends on his eyes. It's a nice bookend.
It's a beautiful bookend, but a wonderful establishing shot as you pull back. And being conditioned by the trailer, I'm like, oh, are we starting in the middle of the movie and we're somehow going to flash back or whatever? And then you realize that they're hunting deer. And I was like, wow, what a great scene that was. And it was just the way that the camera pulls back. To me, Matt Reeves' most accomplished. And, you know, I can't wait to see what he does next. I loved his use of the camera. I loved how he would pull back. I loved how he would go from intimate and then he would pull back on a scene and we would look down upon this epic scene where Caesar's over here and everybody's all around him. I loved his use of that. And he did that throughout beginning, middle, and end. And the opening establishing shot I thought was just great. And again, I like that it wasn't what I expected it to be. So it was a great shot. Great way to open the movie.
I really liked the way it opened the movie.
Yeah.
And I liked, as Phil was talking about, I liked that there was a time jump that was 10 years later, and I liked seeing where Caesar is now in his command leadership of the group of apes that he's pulled together.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you, instead of following too directly, it was wonderful to see how it's already progressed. I thought that was very successful. And also you get to see the next generation of apes coming into it, because how is that going to affect him and the genetics of it, because he's somewhat altered as well. So you got, you get to see how it, and that also leads to the next one, because now you got a whole nother generation.
Right.
So that was fun. There were lots of it that I liked, lots of it that I had problems with, and it was just, but overall it was a fun movie and I enjoyed it. And as being part of the whole storied franchise, as I mentioned earlier, I think, yeah, this thing stands up. This thing's really good. Lots of fun. Lots of it I thought was really, you know, it was just too obvious for me, and they were making decisions. I'm going, why? I mean, okay, I guess the only difference is they're apes doing it rather than anybody else. And for me, that part really bothered me. It was like, for instance, the shot of Kobo hopping, you know, he's on horseback and all the fire and the gun. It's like, that's a shot I've seen a million times, and oh, but the only difference is it's an ape doing
it. It's an ape.
Oh, excuse me, a bonobo to be specific. Yeah. And I kept going, there was a few shots like that. I'm going, why are they doing, you know, are they trying to suggest that, see, oh, are, you know, apes, we're not that much different than apes? Or are they just, you know, because it just seemed like tried and true. And I'm going, well, there's nothing really new or different about that.
But then it's
but then
it's
they climb the power lines.
Yeah, but then it's either
and then they do show the difference. It's like they can do.
No, that part is it. But I'm just talking about in terms of the technique and just using the same shots we've seen a million times.
Well, but then I'll follow that up with, it was either, and I forget. Somebody help me with the chronology, please, because there was either, it either happened right after that scene or just before that scene. There's the wonderful scene with the tank. And I think it happens after that.
Oh,
it's basically the POV of a tank, not so much any character and how everything is playing around the tank. And Matt Reeves talks about how he filmed that shot and what he wanted to get out of it and how important it was, you know, to see, like, you know, he was influenced by so many things, and he wanted, like, how that shot, he goes, yeah, it was a pretty easy shot to film. I just, we put the camera on a tank and we let it roll.
Yeah,
and he goes, but it was filling in all the blanks after we shot it. That was really important to me and getting that done. And for me, that was actually one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I thought it was just the way that it was done. I was like, wow, I haven't seen that before. Mm-hmm. And I loved how it played out and how I got to see the whole epic scope
of this
battle.
It felt like it was
battle.
A panorama.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was good, but
I'll disagree with one of the things that you had said earlier. When he would do those wide shots and then cut or go from a close-up to a wide, for me, I thought their eye lines were all off. I was like, what? Why are you way over there? You had my eye line here, and now we're way over. And it's like, why are you doing that? You're ruining. You're taking me out of the movie.
Mm.
And for me, his eye lines were all off.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of those, and it drove me nuts. I was like, why are you doing that? I don't understand why you're doing that.
Here's another question I'm going to throw out there, and I don't know. Well, I think it's somewhat important to our conversation of watching a movie. 3D or not 3D?
I did 3D this one.
You 3D'd this one? Did you 3D or not 3D?
I did
3D?
Not
3D. How about you, Phil?
Did not.
All right, so two did and two didn't. I mean, I saw it... And again, in the wonderful, the Cinemark XD 3D, I mean, for me, got up on in a large prestige, large screen format, I saw this in the 3D, and I thought that, wow, they really did take great care, because you did get the, you know, you got the levels of, you get the layers of the forest and of the tribal community that they had built up, you know, compared to the contrast of what the humans had. And I thought, to me, it was very beautiful and to, in some points, even lush, even though it was gray and dark in some certain aspects of the film. But I really thought, and apparently, there's a whole thing too that Matt Reeves, he's like, they wanted to shoot in 3D and he shot in stereo and actually to do this. He didn't necessarily anticipate that he wanted to, but he didn't want to do a conversion. So at the very least, they shot in stereo for 3D. And he was like, he was inspired by, he's like, I didn't want to do it in 3D. But after he saw Life of Pi of all movies, he said, you know what? 3D can be beautiful. And he at least approached it the right way. So I, you know, I've said this before, I think we are in an age now where bad 3D is sort of kind of going away by the, you know, going by the wayside, which is thankfully, thank God, because I don't want to sit through a 2.5 hour movie
bad 3D
getting pummeled to the head, and you know. But yeah, I thought that he did a good job, and he did it right. So yeah. What did you like? You started.
I agree because I mean, I go back and forth between seeing 3D versions of movies and just seeing the normal version, and I think I was at one point sometime tormented by a little bad 3D. Like, I don't want to have something. I get pulled out when something's coming directly at me and I'm noticing. Mm-hmm. But in this film, it just felt more like I was enveloped than things mm-hmm. were coming at me. And in that way, I thought it was really beautiful. Like, I'd have to think back to exact mm-hmm. moments when I was really noticed 3D, and I like that. I like mm-hmm. that it wasn't just standing out like, oh, that was a good use of 3D. That was too. Like, mm-hmm. I like that it's almost just subtle
yeah,
and like
immersive. You don't
want
to know. To
exactly.
be honest, for me anyway, I don't ever want, just if it's great, a great movie or it's a great experience, I don't want to be going, oh, that's a great use of 3D, because
exactly.
then I'm paying attention to the 3D and not the movie. Exactly.
Yeah, and I think good 3D, there are some movies that would exploit 3D, mm-hmm. and you sort of kind of know going in that if I'm going to see it, like, shit's going to be coming at me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A movie like Planet of the Apes and even Edge of Tomorrow, which mm-hmm. I thought was a wonderful use of 3D as yeah. well. If it immerses me and envelops me within the world that the director and all of the filmmakers are creating, including the actors and the talent, if it immerses me into that world a little bit more, I'm like, hey, this is great. Wow, you've added another layer for me to look at. And God, that's beautiful. And you know, I can spin around on a tank and, mm. and catch this, or mm. I can pull back on an ape village and go, wow, that looks great. And yes, there are some movies that will exploit it and, you know, beat it into your head. And you sort of kind of know going in that, okay, shit's going to be flying at me and I might have to duck. But other movies, subtly, like an Avatar, mm-hmm. you know, once you get used to having those glasses on and you're in that world, you're like, wow. You know, there was a reason why people got depressed after Avatar and they go, I want to go back to that world. Yeah, people. So, and I think that Matt Reeves used 3D very judiciously and very wonderfully, along with the cinematographer. So,
Phil, you didn't have the 3D experience, but how overall was it for you, that the experience of just watching the movie?
I certainly enjoyed it. I mean, to me, there's times I could have definitely seen this in 3D. Mm-hmm. When I do see a 3D movie, sometimes I do go for the enjoyment, like Shark Night, when a shark literally just comes at you.
Yeah.
You have to know, like, that's what you're getting into with that particular
right.
movie.
Right.
But, you know, again, I can't speak to it because I didn't see this in 3D, but I don't mind the experience, and I think this could have been a great movie in 3D. But sometimes there are movies I feel like that are just simply made for 3D and
yeah.
they don't work in 2D. This was obviously not the case,
yeah.
so I'm glad for that.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it in 2D, so, mm-hmm. but I think I may be missing a gene or something because I don't. The 3D experience is like, yeah, whatever.
Well, do you know there
doesn't
is
do
a?
Much for me.
I've done studies on this mm-hmm. Just through work. There mm-hmm. there is a percentage of people who can't see 3D, mm-hmm. like regardless, and there is a test.
Oh, I can see it.
I should try to have a test.
I think I can definitely see it.
Test.
I know when it's happening. Yeah. I can see it, but I'm not. It doesn't enthrall me like it does others. But,
mm-hmm. I think I'm also in that percentage you've told me once. Like sometimes, like. I see, like, the focus of the camera really
sure.
affects me. Like, mm-hmm. how, like, quickly, like, they change the focus. Mm-hmm. And, like, I can tell, like, when it gets, like, blurry and it, like, shakes as I see it. And it, like, drives me nuts.
And you know, mm-hmm. I can be with you, and that's can lead to the headaches. But, again, I'll say watching it in, like, the XD, at least what they've been able to capture mm-hmm. with large screen format is that, A, it's bright enough
mm-hmm, right.
for 3D to work.
That, yeah.
It's bright. I mean, I took my glasses
this was
off.
Many times this was a very dark film.
Yeah, and I took my glasses off, and mm-hmm. I was like, wow, yeah, it really is truly brighter than a typical screen. So they get that taken care of. And then mm-hmm. it gets blown up, and so it's like, okay, how is the projector, how are they going to digitally be able to, you know, without much blur and whatever, and at least thus far, in this format, since I can't see true IMAX, mm-hmm. within this XD format, whatever movie I've seen, whether it be Captain America, we were there, Godzilla, this movie, mm-hmm. X-Men, the action has looked great. And I don't get dizzy from it. I'm able to follow it. It doesn't look too blurry. Mm-hmm. And again, I just think that goes back to the technology that we're seeing today, that it's mm-hmm. just gotten a lot,
mm-hmm.
it's gotten a lot better than... Mm-hmm.
Clearly,
yeah. So, which is good, and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Like, if I were to say, if you're watching this and you plan on seeing it again, and you didn't see it in 3D, My vote is to check it out.
If you're
going to
see it again, definitely see it in the other format. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that would be a good
idea. Check it out. I think you'd have a, you know, you'd enjoy it as much.
So you might even more. Who knows?
Who knows?
So let's talk about the development of this. Obviously, when Rise came out, it did so well, because it did well, considering more than, I guess, better than most people thought, although I was surprised by that, because it was a decent movie and they had a lot of good things going for it. So they decided to make the sequel already. And I guess Rupert Wyatt was originally brought on to obviously direct that one, and since he did such a good job with Rise. But at some point they had changed the production date.
This is my question, because I read a little bit about this, where you brought Rupert on and it originally had a release date. I believe it was around May 23rd-ish of 2014. Right. And he was having a problem with that.
Yeah.
He was saying like he didn't have enough time.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, they're bringing on someone else.
Yeah.
And then eventually he does get that extra time.
Yeah. Well,
they switched around X-Men and
Yeah.
But like, so, I don't know. I feel like
they didn't think he could finish the film and do it properly in the time that they had given him.
Exactly.
And then they brought in somebody else.
Well, they bring
and
in
then
Matt
gave
Reeves
the guy
and
they brought in extra time.
Well, but it's funny because they didn't initially give Matt Reeves extra time. And in fact, Matt Reeves almost didn't do the project, you know, because he came in, up to the point that Rupert left and they bring in Matt Reeves. Matt Reeves took a look at the script and said, this isn't the story I want to tell.
Exactly.
And to him, they said, you know, he thought the interview was over right there and then.
Right.
But then they said, well, what do you want to do? Because apparently Rupert's initial vision was this was going to take place much farther in the future.
Oh, okay.
That the human population was like, it was going to be closer to the original Planet of the Apes almost.
Oh, got it.
We're not there yet.
So, you know, but they were going to skip. They were going to go way farther into the future.
So Caesar wouldn't even be part of this.
He may have. I don't know.
Well,
what
the he's
that
far
in
the future.
You know.
I mean, who knows?
Yeah. So, but Matt Reeves is like, this isn't the story I want to tell. Mm-hmm. He goes, his ideas, I want to make it very Caesar-centric. He goes, you know, I want to follow him. He's your ape. He's your main man or main ape in this case. And at first they sort of kind of balked. And when he was able to work something out, you know, they still had steadfast on that date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they said, can you do it in that date? If you're able to do that, the story that you want to tell,
yeah,
and
we'll go,
he
yeah.
and the writer Mark Bomback, I believe, they sat down and they banged out a script that they wanted to do, and it got approved, and he was good to go. And they still hadn't changed the release date, because that happened a little bit later on this year, where they switched. Because X-Men was supposed to come out a little bit later.
And it was changed even more. It was originally, I believe, like July 17th, and then they moved up to July 11th, and it's been all over the place.
Yeah. But it was supposed to come out in, I want to say, Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, that was the original.
So, but then they pushed it back. Yeah. So, you know, X-Men was already... And hey, it was a good move on Fox.
Yeah, it worked to them, because it now being released at this point, what else is out there that can compete with that?
And, exactly.
And obviously,
had X-Men come out too, I mean,
right,
you know, same thing. Look, Fox, the news came out this week, first studio this year to reach over $1 billion. In part,
that being with a dismal July 4th weekend. I mean, my God, they were talking about this is the worst it's been in how many years?
Yeah, it's, you know, the
people are appreciating nature.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about summer movies and down and whatnot, but look what X-Men did.
Yeah.
X-Men was $100 million, opened up in a holiday weekend, did really well. How to Train Your Dragon did okay for them, but then you have Apes, which comes out at a perfect date, and either movie,
and they look like geniuses.
Of course. You know, and so they give Matt Reeves a little extra time. Mm-hmm. They had their great X-Men movie come out, which did really well. So it benefited them. It definitely benefited Don and Matt Reeves and company. And they were able to release a movie that they wanted to release.
For me, I think that one of the best decisions was to go with 10 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So we could see, and I agree. Caesar, because
I don't really know, but in the first one,
you know, Rise, I really was following Caesar's story. To me, that was the best thing about that movie.
Right.
See his progression from this.
I agree.
Yeah, and then to see him not only take leadership, but to really be ensconced as the leadership and then to lose it, so to speak. I thought that was a great decision.
And then what I'll add to that is that I didn't have the initial connection to Caesar, being that I didn't see Rise. And I was so drawn in to him throughout this whole film that that is actually one of the reasons that I would go back and see Cesar Eyes, because I did have the thought of, I really like this character. I'm getting a little bit of backstory. I want to know more. And I'm sure I could find that in other movies. So it wasn't just something where you had a character that you got to expand and love. Like, I found a character that I loved in this movie and wanted to know more about.
Yeah. And if you had seen any of the original Apes movies, Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
There's a nice tie-in to all that.
I mean, like, they took, because in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which dealt primarily with Cornelius and Zero, when they make it to Earth, there is a monologue about a disease that basically killed off, it basically killed off all the pets, the main pets, cats and dogs. Mm-hmm. For some reason, cats and dogs could, every other pet in the world is fine, the but cats and dogs, and it domestic. Elevated... And it elevated the chimps or apes intelligence.
To pet status.
But then it elevated them to pet status and they, and then.
I just thought everyone really liked like Jane Goodall stuff.
Sort of. And then, and then Caesar was born of Cornelius and Zira and such. But there are nice nods to the original that didn't even Matt Reeves himself.
Right.
Like, says, hey, I was a huge fan of these movies, especially the original.
Yeah, and there was stuff in,
and even
stuff
in Rise.
Yeah, absolutely. Had, so there's all that kind of stuff going on. And I also like the, with Maurice and his relationship with the son.
Well,
I can't remember the character's son's name.
You're talking about Malcolm's son.
Yeah, Malcolm's son. What's his name?
Ash?
No, Alexander?
Yeah, Alexander. Yeah, with the whole book and the writing and all that kind of stuff.
Parallel from the book to
The parallel from the book to the movie and stuff like that. But also because in the original, it's the orangutans that are the kind of like the ones that are teachers and the lawgivers and all that other stuff. And so you see that connection, and he's the one that's teaching here. So all that stuff was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
you don't need to know that, but it's fun.
No, but it is fun. Mm-hmm. And in this movie too, the orangutan Maurice, he's not Dr. Zaius.
No,
he's not Dr. Zaius. But such a great sympathetic, such a great characterization. And again, this is where I find that, it can go wrong on so many levels. Mm-hmm. But when I find that I'm drawn in, I'm like, okay, the movie works. Mm-hmm. It has its issues. I had some issues myself. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to point out that I think the apes in general. Whether it be Caesar or Maurice or Koba, I thought that their characters were compelling on more than just the visual level, than just the actors coming through, but their character development, their stories were fascinating. And I went into this movie being like, okay, I think I was like, do I have to pick a team? Because I did. I thought it was going to be an all-out battle.
Right.
I was going to be like, which side am I going to choose? And I'm like, I'm going to try and choose the ape side. And I was like, I didn't even have to try. I loved the ape side. Uh-huh. But yeah, so I think that their character work just held up completely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. To my point is that's what draws you in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you forget about the fact that it's motion capture, that it's a special
effect. Yeah, that they did really well. I mean, let's take all the hair away and they're just humans, it'd still be an interesting characterization and that kind of stuff.
And again, going back to the Charlton Heston, I mean, this movie does what that movie did as well. Like, we look, the apes are us. And it just gives us a different perspective. It turns us on our heels, so to speak, and it makes the world upside down. And,
And the hypocrisy of it all. And that's the thing that you're really faced with in the original. Oh, yeah, that's us.
Us. And you're ashamed.
Of course.
And Charlton Heston's character is like, his arc in that movie is like, so he's so cynical at the beginning, and then he's like, he hates it. And then he's like, son of a, he goes, damn it, okay, maybe we can. And then, when he finds out at the end, it's us. Son of a bitch. It was us all along. And this movie, I think, captures this in a way in which the apes are reflections of the humans, and that's what I love.
I think they did it both, because as we were talking earlier, it was more than anything, it was showing that there are good apes and bad apes and good humans and bad humans.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, making sure, and I don't know if that was a little too politically correct or not, but because, I mean, let's face it, Koba and Dr. Dreyfuss are pretty much the same.
Yeah, to an extent, you know. I think that they made...
I was thinking more Brutus than Caesar, but...
Yeah, but that was the thing that I found interesting. It also bothered me like crazy because, to me, You know, like, for instance, stuff, well, storylines, I should say, okay, his wife, she's ill. Oh, just happen to have a nurse here who's going to say, it's like, so much of it was, I was like, really? It's so obvious. Couldn't you find a better way into that? I mean, because to me, too much stuff was the same. I've seen a million times. And I guess it was supposed to be different because this is apes and humans and not just humans. And it, I go, God, find a different way in or more interesting. Because I get why they use Shakespearean stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, why not? You know, archetypes we all can understand. But I just thought it was too obvious on the ways in, and they didn't come at it obliquely enough because we're in a world that it shouldn't be the same.
Right. And, well, here's my thing. Like, did I mean, one of my little pet peeves about the movie was after, you know, because I watched Rise and everything, there wasn't one time where Caesar said, "Hey, I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for humans. Like, I'm the way I am because of a good human. Like, you can use humans as an example. Hello, here I am."
Well, the only hint at it was when he says he was a good man like you. That was the only.
That was the only time. Like,
yeah, I agree.
To, like, Koba. Like, Koba's humor, hatred for humans, you understand.
Absolutely.
But there wasn't any time where, like, Caesar said to Koba, "Settle down."
That's true. Look. But he tried to do it with his son because he said the only thing Koba learned from humans
was hate.
But he was prime example, a primate example.
But he could have pointed a few finger back at himself, and then, like, while Koba's pointing to his scars, he could point to himself and be like,
"Point to himself,
but
goes,
I am awesome."
I'm guessing they were assuming that point was made, but I understand that it would have been. I think it would have been way more because he was trying to teach his son something, and they never gave him the opportunity to teach. They kept holding up, which is fine. Suspend it. But they never really got him a chance to make that with the son. Because the son, I'm guessing, is going to be part of the next. Maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know.
That would have been interesting to see because this is the son who's got bright eyes. They call him blue eyes in a sense. But he's the first offspring of the genetically altered. I don't know if it's genetically, but obviously Caesar is altered in some fashion.
Yeah, he is. And again, I was just waiting for that line of dialogue. Like, you go hating the humans.
Exactly.
Like, you know, I'm a product of them. And and this is what happened. Like, you know, there are good and bad. I know, to your point, like, maybe they just wanted the audience to make that leap on their own, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
But you would have had, again, you would have had to have seen the first movie, or Rise, I should say. You would have had to have seen Rise to understand Caesar's...
Yeah, his
like,
fault.
Why Caesar is... You know, how he got to be where he is, and he had good nurturing behind him, and I don't know.
I guess I just thought that was obvious in a way.
That part may have been because they obviously went to the video for that. But I think that I understand.
But even before that,
Dimitri's point is it would have been much more effective if he had taken a chance at having that conversation.
Yeah, because
with the son,
or to the tribe, or somebody,
anything.
And you know, because I was wondering, going here, you have a perfect opportunity here to say, hey, before let's like, because it was always came up like, why do you trust the humans?
And here's why, because it's the same conversation that Malcolm tried to have with Dreyfus.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And it would have been interesting to see the parallel in the ape world.
And my only difference between Dreyfus
and
Koba is that, like, Dreyfus, you understood his distrust, let's say. I don't think he necessarily took it to that next level.
Like Carver.
Like, he wasn't like Carver.
No.
You know, he was a little bit more, I would say, I'll give the Dreyfus character a little bit more intelligence. Mm-hmm. You understood his distrust.
Sure.
And it was never, his distrust was never given, like, the seed to try to, like, unfortunately, Malcolm couldn't introduce him to Caesar.
Yeah.
And say, hey, you know, because maybe he would... Carver was not going to be swayed, but maybe Dreyfus could have been, and Dreyfus wouldn't take to murdering somebody, I don't think.
This is where I'm... I just felt like, as much as I like Gary Oldman, I liked his portrayal of it, the Dreyfus character was really boring to me. Mm-hmm. Like, he had a couple good scenes.
Boring,
like,
why? Because it was obvious, or what?
Yeah, it was, like, obvious. I was kind of like, okay, you need some, I guess, counterpart to Malcolm, but... I was feeling like that was being more fulfilled by the gun-happy guy.
Carver.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Dreyfus was just... I was, every time he's come on screen, I was like, okay, let's go back to either the world or to Malcolm, because I'm just not that centered on his story. I think it's pretty obvious how the humans are fearful or trying to make contact or relying on power. Mm-hmm. These are, you're just stating the obvious to me, mm-hmm. and I didn't really need it.
It felt like, and I don't know if this is true, but it felt like there was a bigger story to him. Dreyfus, mm-hmm. I should say, because they obviously took the time to show his family on right. that. So obviously, how much is he's lost? He's lost his entire family, all that kind of stuff. But it felt like there should have been more to that story, and they might have edited it for time. But because it was like, what? I agree with you. What's the point if you're not really going to further that or deepen that?
Yeah.
It's like any person could have been trying to blow up the tower at the end,
and that, and to go any from person to go from have... the guy in the beginning who we met as Dreyfus to a guy that's just. Screw it. I'm just going to blow everything up.
Well, but...
There was no progression.
How I saw that was, mm-hmm. is that they were attacked. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't looking at it as just a knee-jerk reaction. Like, Carver just shot the ape mm-hmm. without, like, you know, he shot... Like, the ape, I don't think, was going to attack or jump... Mm-hmm. Their compound was attacked.
I know, but he, so I know, but his saying is, "I'm saving humanity." But he's, but he clearly knew he wasn't saving humanity. I mean, estimation.
I think he was trying. Yeah. You know, again, he was a little bit different than Koba for me because he wasn't trying to usurp. Like he was the leader. He wasn't to usurp that.
But they both are trying to destroy the other. At the end, that's it. That's all they wanted to do is destroy the other.
Well, they were viciously attacked. I mean, he saw it. I mean, that attacks
him. They both are viciously attacked. Yeah. So therefore, I guess what we can learn about don't viciously attack.
But Koba, you know, in Koba, what Koba did too was very, you know, Shakespearean manipulative and even from his talk, even prior to him shooting Caesar,
the talk that he had with blue eyes
was like, that was scary to me. Yeah. He's like, you know, nobody's going to be able to protect your Caesar.
Sure.
You have to look out for him because of the evilness that's around him.
I am the danger.
Yeah. So, you know, but I love those aspects. Yeah. I love those aspects of this movie. I thought to an extent they worked.
I did. Yeah. I did enjoy them, but I also, I've already.
You felt that they were simple.
It was like they were. It was obvious the way they got into him, and I went, you're just stealing from everybody. You're not doing a very deft hand at stealing it. And in this world, can't it be a slightly different version? Because it just seemed too much like, anyway, it's too obvious and too much like humans instead of something slightly oblique and slightly off what it would normally, or what we've seen a million times.
And because I thought the music captured that.
No, I'm just talking about the scenes.
I will say is that, yeah, there are some predictable elements, but also for me, I think that was, I didn't think focus on that too much because the end turned out much different than I thought it would. Mm. I went into this going, okay, it's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Mm. Obviously, this is going to become Planet of the Apes, which means they're going to win. Like, that's what I'm just assuming this is going to be. And at the end, you know, you have the physical Dawn happening over the tower. I'm like, oh, this is it. Either Koba's going to, like, change his mind or Koba's gonna win or something's going to happen that this is why, you know, they take over. This is why they have the power. And it was done differently. Mm-hmm. It was done so that he kind of had to Caesar had to kind of lean back and realize like, oh, an ape started this war, like we're going into now a bigger battle and like we have to. And it was like a place of like sorrow and
what's the reluctant hero the whole way. He doesn't want to fight at all. And then at the end of the movie, he's basically resigned himself to saying, we are
good. And how that happened, I really enjoyed. And I thought that it was done really well. And it wasn't like, okay, everybody get ready to charge. It wasn't like this big, huge upheaval. It was like, we're now in this mess and we have to do this.
Yeah.
And that was completely different than what I expected.
See, it's saying like when you talk about originality and I've seen it like to me when that dialogue happened and it was great dialogue, you know, I just in my head the quote that came into mind and that's the Clone Wars have begun. Like we're not going to be able to stop this. It's path.
Yeah, and there's this self-recognition and like the, you know, I don't know. I just thought that was done really well. And I just vividly. I was so convinced that the dawn was happening over the tower. I was like, it's the dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And then I was like, oh.
No, but I do.
Not that way.
I agree. I loved Caesar's storyline. I loved his arc. I thought they did a really successful job on that part.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And as Matt Reeves, I mean, Matt Reeves, you know, Caesar's the Don Corleone of the Apes. He's just trying to keep
his family
the
together.
Peace. He's trying to keep his family together. Mm. And he doesn't want his son to go down.
So in the third one, they're going to pull him back in? Is that what's going
to happen? Yeah, they're going to change the consigliere. Yeah, you know, we're not going to have an orangutan anymore. It's going to be somebody else's more tan. No. But, you know, it's, again, I liked, and I'm very happy that Reeves was able to get this story out other than what they purportedly had in mind. And I'm glad in this case that the studio heads sort of listened.
Well, the other part that was fun was that it happened in San Francisco. If it happened way in the future, there's not much left to destroy, I'm guessing. So I liked that part of it.
But if you remember, like, and again, one of the original endings, like, we saw an alternate ending to this. Mm-hmm. But you remember in the posters, like, it showed the San Francisco, the Bay Bridge, and that never shows up.
The Golden Gate.
The Golden Gate. Yeah, my apologies.
Yes,
No offense.
Please, live there.
The Golden Gate Bridge, and that's not in the movies at all.
I know, that kind of pissed me off.
Because apparently...
talking about bait and switch.
Apparently there was a big war that, you know, and again, Matt Reeves, like, I don't want to go that big. He goes, I want Dawn
to be a little bit character, and I want
it to be a battle, but I want it to be an intimate battle. Mm-hmm. I want it to draw people in. This isn't the war.
And that so they, is they the did war. Change. Yeah. This is just the battle. Yeah.
He wanted this to lead into something bigger, and he didn't want to,
Are you talking about the alternate ending?
Yeah.
Like the one that wasn't released.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You saw that?
I didn't see it.
Matt Reeves talked about how basically.
But that was such a weird bait and switch. I'm seeing the posters. I'm going, because the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, it got roughed up a little bit in Rise. Let's put it that way.
Well, supposedly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the alternate ending does take place like where they're on the Bay Bridge, they're seeing warships coming in. It's like this big, huge, grand scene.
Right. But I don't know. This is an alternate ending that you saw or that you heard
that
about?
That I heard about.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, they ended up not going with that because he wanted it to be focused more on, you know, Caesar's story, what Caesar went through. He wanted that to be the lasting impact. And you're not thinking, oh, look at all the warships. You're thinking, look at what Caesar's
He wanted to play more poignant.
Yeah, he wants the impending doom of what's going
on. But the shot, end shot of Caesar is him technically on the Golden Gate, I believe, looking at the warships. And, like, you can kind of see them come into his eyes or something.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh,
so maybe there was some Golden Gate footage. It was just you only saw this much. Yeah, it was outside the frame.
So that was the one thing that actually bothered me, because during the movie I'm going, when are we going to get to the Golden Gate? I don't understand. Where is that? And it never happened. Well, I kept going, what?
I mean, the more combat focused original ending was hinted in the marketing of the film.
Sure.
Including clips from the final trailer featuring, you know, lines about military and shots of large military ships heading towards San Francisco, which we never really saw.
But
I do like how he wanted it to be a more poignant, like,
no, this that part is was great.
The doom and gloom
just drove me, but that ruined it for me. Oh, it didn't ruin it, but that really was in my brain as I'm watching it, because I kept going, how are they going to get to the Golden Gate?
That was like Dinobots for me with Transformers. Like, the whole time I was like, where are the Dinobots? And they came at the very end.
For me, that was I was not a happy viewer because of that.
Well, Reeves did mention that there will be an extended version of this when it comes out on Blu-ray, which could explain a little bit more about Gary Oldman.
They could have been fine just having it. They could have had a poster in San Francisco. That would have been just as good to me. But, you know, but no.
Yeah.
So, whatever.
Do you feel let down?
I did. I'm going in my seat, and I'm going, okay. You just kind of blew that for me, because I'm watching this waiting for the big thing to happen. Oh, we're done?
Yeah. And it's not happening.
Oh.
I mean, it must be hard, though, being that so much of the filming of this, you know, he has a vision for everything he's filmed, but you don't get to see really your footage until it gets back to you. Right. And you're getting it section by section. This isn't something you can just like be like, oh, let me scan
well,
through all
actually,
my footage.
They're able to see their footage pretty quick.
But he wasn't getting like completed segments like all at the same time. He's getting them.
No, he was probably getting like edited versions. Scenes and stuff
like
that.
Well, they can get their. I mean, it's all digital, so they can see. They can. I'll put it this way: they can see stuff as soon as it's shot, is put up on a cloud, and like moments after they shoot it, they can pretty much share it with people, and they can edit
in on the fly,
like iTunes. They can.
Did we miss anything before we leave this? Did we miss anything? Great. Okay, we did.
So they have an idea, and plus they probably too are pre-vising the whole thing out too, so they know. Through a smaller kind of animatics, they have an idea as to what how the movie is going to look like. So you know, and if he had this alternate ending in mind, you know, I mean, I get it. It's like saying I don't want to start so many years in the future. I want to make this more Caesar centric. And I get I don't want a big battle. I want it to be a more poignant, and I want it to be a little bit dark, which is cool because when you look at all of the Planet of the Apes movies. Mm-hmm. They all are sort of kind of nihilistic. Like, their endings are not happy endings.
None of them are.
Yeah. And so this one sort of kind of leaves on that.
Like, for instance, I don't think Sarah should see, and forgive me for not knowing which particular ape movie it is, but it's the one where it's in our world, not the ape world, and it's when they all turn.
Oh.
All the quote pets and...
That's,
they all turn on the
conquest.
Humans. Exactly.
Conquest.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Conquest.
Don't think I want to see
don't
that.
See that one, Sarah.
Yeah, you don't want to see that.
That's the thing
one.
That you just go.
You know, and then we,
just,
well, let's
just
take
beat
a look
the crap
at
out of everybody.
The original Planet of the Apes. Yeah. We realize man did this.
Yep.
This is man. Like, this is why
it's.
This is what it is. And beneath the Planet of the Apes, they just say
it's
fuck
all
it. And they blow it all up. They just blow it all up and escape from Planet of the Apes. Cornelius and Zara get shot. They get murdered. They get killed.
Yep.
Conquest. That's exactly what it
that's
is.
When Caesar,
that's when Caesar.
Because you this doesn't up. Sound like fun.
Yeah, and then battle for the Planet of the Apes is just that's just all out like cheesy war.
Yeah,
you know. So no, like they don't end. Like they don't end. Like hey, we're all gonna live together. Yeah.
Well, they're cautionary tales.
Cautionary
all of them.
Tales.
All
like
of them.
Cautionary tales is that's great. Yes.
Yes.
So.
But this was
so
our opportunity for peace.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah, and the other.
But I did like that aspect of it because in the human world, in our world, there's hawks everywhere that just want to show strength and go kill people. And then and here Caesar is going. Yeah, and how many apes are going to die in the process? I mean, So I liked all those energies and
all those
viewpoints, and you can reflect that again how that affects humans in our world, and you can see ourselves through that because that's exactly what happened. In our war rooms.
Right. Yeah.
They only respect strength. We must kill them all.
Kill them. Kill them all. So, yeah, I mean, they are cautionary tales.
Yeah.
And they are meant for, again, I always say very good science fiction always makes you look at the, it's always about the human condition and it makes you rethink and relook at. Mm-hmm. How we as humans can act towards something or how we react towards something. Mm-hmm. It's always a mirror to society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And very good science fiction brings that out. And that's why I think like the original Planet of the Apes is such a... I think even today it holds up.
Yeah, when you're watching it, if you decide to go back and watch it, you're going to have to just kind of chill because it takes its time to get there.
It does
because they did back then.
But we talk again.
Yeah. Once it gets in there, then it's like.
But the original Planet of the Apes again. It wasn't predicated. This was a day and time where movies weren't predicated so much on the action.
No.
They were predicated on building up a character. And
I'm just talking how long it took from the crash to when they actually. Yeah. It's like, geez, they're traveling.
Yeah. It's a long time, and then Charlton Heston can't speak for.
Yeah, I know. So then there's all that. So.
Yeah, it's very interesting,
but it's fun for sure.
Yeah.
All right, before we go, because I want to talk, we haven't talked a lot about acting. I want to get into that.
Yeah,
but is there
yeah.
anything else we want to talk about, story or script or anything like that? Because we pretty much.
Well, there was a great story I was telling Phil about this. And I think it's a great studio story. Mm-hmm. So Matt Reeves is talking about inserting subtitles. mm-hmm. into the movie.
For the ape talk.
For the ape talk and for the sign and whatever. Mm-hmm. So talking to Fox, mm-hmm. he said, well, he goes, you know, there was this little movie called Avatar. You guys might be familiar with it because you released it, and that had a lot of subtitling mm-hmm. in it, and you know, and it was proven to work. And the Fox executives were like, yeah, don't be confusing yourself with Avatar. Like, don't. Avatar is Avatar. Mm-hmm. And pretty much telling Matt Reeves, like,
take a step
like,
down. Yeah,
he's like, and again, I was just like, sure, under the heading of you're misunderstanding, I like, I'm yeah, not exactly. thinking I'm delivering you Avatar.
No, I'm just talking about subtitling.
You, like, subtitling.
It's been
and,
done.
And yeah, and it's like, so it'll work.
So they really had a hard problem with the yes. with the subtitles?
Yes.
I don't understand. Yes. Like, I would be and mad if those
nobody wants to see a summer movie with and read.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't understand sign. So I
and that
can't,
added
you
so
know,
much.
Yeah, what were they thinking was the alternative? That these all these apes were going to just know how to talk? Is that maybe
it
that's
could
what
be.
They?
Well,
that
in the future been they were
sure,
talking.
That makes sense.
And that, and he's like, no, he goes, I want the audience to know.
And right. I thought that added so many layers there. The yeah. village being some
absolutely.
Sign.
Yeah,
I don't know. Their sound sometimes. And then there was still the element of they had to fight once, like to show power.
Nobody
and
has
And then they
ever,
had words sometimes. I yeah. thought it was great.
Nobody has ever said that the studio system of yeah, creative well, execs yeah, are on the money.
Well, they
but
really
I just found it
the
funny that he said, well, you know, Avatar used it in such a great way. Yeah. And like and they're
don't
like
confuse
don't
yourself.
Confuse yourself with that.
Well, that's a very
that,
interesting.
To me, that's
just
it
sounds
terrible.
Like somebody or whomever is espousing that viewpoint. It's just yeah. an advocacy for the lowest common denominator. We don't want anybody to have to read. We don't yeah. want like they're not a, and, like we weren't intelligent enough to figure out what he was. I mean,
did it bother you? If no. Phil, did it bother you?
Yeah, Phil's of all of us. Phil one is the one that hates to read the most.
Exactly.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, he's
to be fair, there. I mean, I actually enjoyed it a lot, but there was one portion where they really sped it up, and I was like, I couldn't. Sometimes I hate when you can't keep up.
Right.
And that's the only problem I have. But most of it was really it was mm-hmm. done really beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that I would have been lost actually because I don't understand ape speak
right.
and there were especially the first 15 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. Yes, we all understand this and go.
Yeah,
but all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or especially you know, like the. Like, I'm just recalling, like, the moments where you have them discussing that they're not going to tell Caesar about the guns. Mm-hmm. Like, that was all done mm-hmm. in sign. If I yeah. didn't have that, mm-hmm. that would have been such a lingering question. Like,
agree.
Why did no one tell him about the guns?
Agree.
And, like, there was a lot of that. Like, this. Yeah.
It makes
like,
you happy that yeah. Matt Reeves won that
yeah.
battle.
Yeah, that was.
You know.
That
so.
Just seems like a silly idea. We can't have subtitles. And it
good
wasn't
job,
like
Matt
there was
Reeves.
An overuse of subtitles.
No.
No.
It was just a layering effect. Yeah. So there's
okay. All right.
So I wanted to before we go into acting.
Yeah.
We asked. I thought that that was a very interesting story.
It was
geared towards production mm-hmm. of this fine movie.
So
let's talk about some actors.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of Andy. You want to jump in first?
I mean, so I thought it's just interesting. First of all, I want to hand it to them because I think that one of the things that makes it so great is they do give a lot of time to not. To the emotional level, to the character level, to getting people comfortable acting like apes. Like, for instance, I know that they had, like, an ape camp before they started filming where everyone went in for, like, weeks mm-hmm. and just did, like, improv mm-hmm. and giving the actors that, like, room to just mm-hmm. be, like, creative and just live off each other and create a hierarchy, mm-hmm. create a way of communicating with each other, I think worked really mm-hmm. well. And I mean, they say it's all about the eyes, and that's mm-hmm. why you get the bookend and the focus, because it was. Mm-hmm. And how much they translated to these creatures was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I felt like I knew each one of them. Yeah, I love Andy Serkis. I think that mm-hmm. he's known as kind of one of the masters of mm-hmm. this technique. And he talks always about how it is because he just internalizes everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that he holds no judgment on what he is playing. It's not like, I'm going to play Caesar to just be an aggressive ape. He just plays Caesar, who's someone who's impacted right. by the circumstances.
Yeah, he plays and that as comes, character. Just
exactly.
happens to be an ape. But, which yeah. is the way you should do it. The way you should approach it. Yeah,
yeah and, you know, we motion capture, you know, I don't... Right now, the only thing that comes comes to mind, like, one of the first movies to really utilize it. Robert Zemeckis did it in The Polar Express. Mm-hmm. And back then when, you know, I mean, thank mm-hmm. you, Robert Zemeckis, because mm-hmm. at least you brought this to the attention. And it got some mixed reviews. Most people like what it could do, and at least some creative people mm-hmm. like Peter Jackson mm-hmm. was able to think forward enough and take this mm-hmm. this and bring it to a new level. And then, you know, then you get the dawn and the birth of like Andy Serkis. And then mm-hmm. when we're introduced to Gollum, mm-hmm. you know, the first time, and then you realize that somebody's actually playing that, you go, wow, that's mm-hmm. pretty amazing. And then he goes on and he does King Kong. Mm-hmm. You know, he was King
Which
Kong.
Which version?
The Peter Jackson version. Dino De Laurentiis was all mechanical.
I know.
With Jessica Lange. And
it was all the same.
It was motion, you know,
about?
He was motion capture, and, mm-hmm. he captured that fine. And, mm-hmm. you know, as far as performances
go.
He's
doing very well with the primate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His
and
monkey making, sounds are on.
But all of them.
To me, what the amazing part is, I mean, he's doing this stuff, but, you know, for The Hobbit, mm-hmm. he was running basically a second unit directing, you know what I mean? And so the amount of talent that he actually has as just a human being within film is phenomenal. I think it's being able to take that, understanding, okay, how does motion capture work? How does an actor work? Mm-hmm. How does the camera work? And how does editing ultimately work? And then visual effects to make all of what I'm doing, you know, possible. So that
they end up on the screen.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's so much going on. I mean, they have progressed this technology to, you know, the fact that they now can bring these to locations and they get to film most of this, like, outside with multiple people in these suits. But dealing with the fact that he's playing another species, the fact that he's dealing with like three ways of communication,
and all the technical stuff involved, forget all the technical stuff, so you can actually just be portray.
That with the suit with this thing in front of your face. It's not comfortable. They're sweating. They're talking about how they smell so bad they don't want to be around people. Which and then you're bringing perfect. This character to life. But it's wonderful.
Well, and again, going, you know, just furthering a point too, like Rise of the Planet of the Apes was mostly shot on a stage. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the smell, like they were on a stage so they can get out of their costume, 85% of Dawn was shot on location.
Exactly.
So think about, aside from motion capture, you know, Matt Reeves said, 85% of this is on location. We've got motion capture going on. I'm filming in stereo, mm-hmm. like, which really is difficult to do because, you know, you got to line up the cameras and get everything done. So they really push the envelope mm-hmm. as far as special effects go for this movie. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it all, to have motion capture being what it is, capturing the fur of the animals, which, you know, in the first movie, again, when you're on stage, it was just different. Now that he's dealing with an army of apes, and trying to capture the personalities, the colors, and, you know, they said doing the fur was, you know, mm-hmm. we couldn't cheat it. Mm-hmm. You know, even though it was filmed primarily, there were some scenes that were, you know, that were filmed in the dark, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes you get, well, they're filming in the dark because they're trying to hide. And maybe mm-hmm. he said we couldn't really do that because we were on location. Yeah. You can't cheat when you're on location that much. And mm-hmm. so you respect the hard, you respect actually, again, that collaborative effort of what it took, mm-hmm. because what you see on screen is truly, you know, it really is fantastic. And again, it makes the experience so immersive. If it didn't work, all of us here in this room, I think, would point out, it was just silly. It would have looked silly. Mm-hmm. But because it worked so well, and they took so much care to make it work, I think kudos to them, because you're able to pull off a Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and you have empathy mm-hmm. and character, and you have the humans, which I thought Jason Clarke, I thought, was really good. He played Malcolm.
Yeah, he had great pathos.
I liked him. And he was, what I liked about Jason Clarke is that he was, like, you could see him thinking and going, mm-hmm. oh, God.
Yeah, you really get, he was able to externalize his internal conflict.
Yeah.
So that was wonderful.
I like that. And Kerry Russell, I thought, mm-hmm. was good. A Matt Reeves favorite. This is back in the Felicity days. Mm-hmm. And, I even like the kid that played the son.
Cody Smith McPhee.
Yeah, I liked him. In the scene, again...
I'm going to look him up.
Yeah, I liked how that scene with him giving him the graphic novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was good.
Even the scene between he and Carrie was a wonderful little moment. That was it was great to bring that
in. Yeah. So humans and motion capture.
Yeah, I thought everybody that acted on this did a good job. Even Carver, who I thought was written very two-dimensional.
Yeah. He did a good job.
But he did a good job with what he had to do, what they gave him. Absolutely. Yeah. And there are people that are completely have such preconceptions about other people that's just who they are. Then it doesn't matter what you say, doesn't matter what the facts are, they're still going to go, well, I don't care. I want to kill them.
I don't care. Yeah.
So there are those people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think performance wise, and again, if you don't have it, the movie doesn't work. It really does. Again, special effects are a tool. We say this before. And if you don't have the performance behind it, it doesn't work.
Yeah. So in acting wise, I thought everybody did a really good job. Yeah. I don't remember anyone where I went.
And
I think that's partially also, you said, Dimitri, it's a collaboration. Mm-hmm. It's what they give them. And they did pull out a lot of character moments for them. A lot of scenes that were, kind of slower, like the Carrie Russell Cody scene where they're just kind of in that small little space
talking. Waiting, exactly. Quiet moment.
That's when you do have Gary Oldman's moment with his family. Mm-hmm. Like, those are just small character moments. Yeah. Even like the Carrie Russell Jason Clark hug where she's just listening to him when he's getting ready to pack. Like, those are things that they could have skipped over to cut time. Yeah. And they give the actors these moments. And I think that that's part of why it does work.
Yeah, they gave the scenes a little bit of time to breathe. Mm-hmm. And that point, like, what was the line? Was it something to the effect of, I didn't know you had a daughter or something?
Along those lines, yeah.
Yeah, something to that. And you're like, oh, because you get a sense that they've been together for a while. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got a sense that they were a family. Same. I didn't know that they were a fragmented family that found each other.
Mm-hmm.
Until the dialogue had come out, and I was like, oh, I just learned something new about that. Wow.
Yeah, that was nice.
And the way that it was played out was nice, too.
And
so,
in terms of the acting, when Malcolm and Caesar have that last moment at the end, where I go, okay, now that right there, we've been with the movie up to 2 hours at that point. And to make that moment work, I thought, well, there you go. That's some good stuff.
And they hug,
Well, they have that moment where they do the ape mind meld or whatever you want to call it. And they say, the Maori kind of thing, exactly, where your foreheads touch. And it could have gone way over the top waddling or whatever, but no, I think they had showed enough restraint where it worked for the movie.
I agree. And
I love their conflict when Caesar was saying, I thought we had a chance.
I know, he's so defeated.
Oh, it was Malcolm that said those lines. I can't remember, but at that moment
they both
the point.
Did they both agreed on the concept that they had it. They thought they had a chance.
We were so close. Mm-hmm. And now it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. So, and he tells him, like, just get the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, and you just wonder, will they meet up again? The one thing about the apes.
Or the
movies,
other thing, really, I'm sorry.
No.
About that same kind of moment with Maurice. Run.
Yeah, because
they know what's going to happen in the ape world. You need to get out now.
that was a great scene.
And poor Caesar knows that. We've reached the tipping point. We can't stop this. Get out of here.
And that's a very interesting thing, I think, about the Apes franchise as a whole. And again, we Phil and I talked about this. In most sequels that you see, most typical sequels, there's at least a character that is going on from sequel to sequel to sequel. Yeah. Not in Apes.
No.
Not in the Planet of the Apes franchise. I mean, it's very difficult. Like, you go from Charlton Heston to...
He made an appearance.
He makes a small appearance. He's in that movie for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Then...
He's the one
that pushes the button. But again, like, he isn't the main character following. And then, again, from Escape, they kill off our two people that, Cornelius and Zira. And then we get Caesar. And then we get back. Like, there's no through character to really follow.
Mm-hmm.
It always changes. And to me, that is amazing. When you're setting up a franchise, Like, you couldn't call it Harry Potter if you weren't following Harry Potter through a series of books.
I'm wondering if that was part of the decision-making was, you know, we should keep Caesar because he is our franchise.
But again, he wasn't the main character in Rise.
Yeah, he was.
That
whole second act, we were following his journey to learn what it is to be an ape in the ape world.
True, but we had James Franco. Yeah. We had a human to connect with, so to speak. This one changes. This one's very Caesar.
But to me, I mean, in terms of just story writing, Caesar's the one that goes through the arc, not James.
James sort of kind of does.
Not really.
I think.
What's his arc? He's the same in the beginning as he is at the end.
Well, I'll have to rewatch. But then in this one, we have a new human to follow. We have Malcolm to follow.
So
what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. Like, again, we don't even know if maybe it's Caesar's son. I mean, it's just a fascinating franchise that they don't.
Well, it goes to the choice that, exactly, it's more of an successful overall concept, and, like, I think that based on the time periods they give you, like, it wouldn't make sense to follow one character versus, like, Harry Potter takes place, you know, in
successive years. But my hopefully
Beneath the Planet of the Apes takes place right after
that's true.
Planet.
But don't you think that when they do their next one, whatever it's called, because they haven't really titled it yet,
High Tea,
that Caesar's going to be part of it?
I really hope.
But it's going to be really the Rise of the Sun coming to power.
Rise of the Sun.
Don't you think? Because Caesar's going to be there and he's going to die. And then
did anyone think that besides me that it was going to be Lion King that was going to happen earlier?
Completely. Yes.
I didn't until you mentioned.
I didn't think that when I was watching the movie.
Oh, I did think it when I was watching. I'm totally with you, Phil. Like 100%. Like the evil Uncle Scar.
When he actually gets
with
shot.
The scars and fun. I've got you.
I thought it well when Phil
the
mentioned
falling
that,
off the cliff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when Phil mentioned that, well, too, I was like, except, duh. Well,
I don't think I really went down that road only because Blue Eyes just seemed too young, wasn't big enough or large enough to actually take over.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think.
But then we countered that as well because Simba within the one minute time span grew. So
yeah, I was like, you do have that time lapse.
That's right. You have three minute time. Hakuna Matata.
Yeah,
and
thank you, Phil.
Look at me
bringing it back. Thank you. Appreciate that, Phil.
So as we're talking about, but here's something I think that's interesting since we are talking
more
performance.
Shakespearean references.
Right. Motion capture, Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about this. Yeah, what's the deal? Do you think that the Academy will ever really recognize this?
Okay, here's my only argument why they could was because when adaptation was nominated for best writing, they gave it to a fake guy, as in he doesn't exist. So, you know, why can't you give...
I don't remember what you're talking about. What
adaptation?
I know the movie. I'm just trying to give me more
Charlie
context.
Kaufman wrote it. Clearly. But he also added in a fake brother that co-wrote with him, and they both accepted the speech, or they both accepted the award, except that there is no brother. He is made up.
I don't remember that part.
For this rewards, I think that's... That's just, it's hard. We haven't seen everything for the year.
No, I just mean in general.
Oh, no,
do you think will the Academy acknowledge that this is equally as good as other performances? Because I don't know that it does.
Makeup.
It's kind of like they don't really accept comedies as worthy of winning an Academy Award.
Here's the thing. I think ultimately, I don't know if you start a subcategory of like visual effects acting.
Right.
You know, because obviously there's a visual effects category in itself, but now you're getting into where you're creating, you know, you got Smog, you got the apes, you got Avatar.
So many sub-genres or subcategories of Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately it is a visual effect to an extent, you know what I mean? It's all, it's
and
a combination
how much
of multiple
it is
things.
The actor and how much of it is the effect.
And here's the thing, too, because... I think that the Academy, I think it's a very slippery slope. And the way the Academy traditionally goes is no. But, you know, even, and here's the reason why, and I'm going to take it from the words of like the special effects editor. It's above and beyond makeup. Like, I could look at Roddy McDowall and say, he did a great job because I'm able to see him act.
Yeah, I know what he's feeling.
And know what he's
I can
feeling,
see him thinking.
It's just
like
makeup.
Right.
But Joe Letteri, in an article, Discover Magazine actually had a great, great article about the special effects. It was all about the science of it all. And he goes on. He goes, now these drive a layer of tissue, and that in turn drives the skin. All that can be driven either by the actor's movements or animators, or most of the time a combination of the two. Our animation team has to take over from the actors to do the final interpretation of the human emotion. That yeah. one line right there.
I was going to say, because it's like, where else do you draw the line?
Yeah.
It's so hard because you, I mean, this is pushing it and you're mm-hmm. going to draw too far, but like, even in like classic, even if you go back to classic, like Disney movies, mm-hmm. they would talk about how the animators drew off of yeah. the actors right. who were coming
well,
to
I mean,
and you're talking about constant animation now where they'll literally film the actors in yeah. the studio and use right. their impressions.
Well, it's also,
so it's like, who makes yeah. that?
And you could, you could have your visual effects person, not that they've ever done this, but I'm mm-hmm. sure they we've thought about it. Okay, we didn't get the performance we wanted. Can you just redraw that? Because how many times, Phil, have we yeah. in the editing George, room done that? Hey, wait, run it backwards. Wait, it'll look
stop.
Better.
That's already been done.
I know,
George
clearly.
Lucas has done that. Oh, I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's one of those stories in The Phantom Menace.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
George Lucas was not getting the performance he wanted out of the little boy,
mm-hmm.
and he would digitally enhance scenes to get what he wanted. So, and again, I think that's where the slippery slope lies for the Academy. I don't ever want to take it. I don't want to take anything away from Andy Serkis. I think what he provides to a role in anything mm-hmm. that he has done, and like when you look at Gollum, Gollum is a 3D character. He mm-hmm. seems like somebody that you can touch mm-hmm. and Andy Serkis brings that to the table.
Yeah, but is that really Andy doing that? Because that's well, really the... he's a 3D thing because
like,
of the editor.
I would say that... that's just like... I don't know how to draw the lines around this. Because I think that Andy Serkis probably gives the people... his visual effects people...
a hell of a lot of people...
so
to
much
work with.
To work with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, he creates so much potential because mm-hmm. he does such a fantastic job.
Sure.
And that's why he gets pulled to do these every time.
Right.
But I'm sure there are other actors who maybe we think are doing just as well that maybe they are enhancing. Mm-hmm. And we can never really know who they're enhancing and who they're like, oh, look, this person has done such a good job that we yeah. just have to mimic exactly what they did. And it's perfect.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah.
We're not going to know that.
Yeah.
It's too many hours of work that they've put in for us to be yeah. able to dissect.
Yeah.
Well,
so
forgive me if you might have said this, but I mean, here's the thing. Ultimately, people always talk about, oh, some of the performances were left on the cutting room floor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a reason. There's definitely, like, editing sculpts even actors, right?
Sure, right.
Of course.
And so,
right.
trust me, there's multiple times.
What are you talking about, Phil? I'm shocked to hear this.
Hey, some people get so obsessive about, oh, the deleted scenes, like why would you delete right. such great performances or whatever, mm-hmm. this must be like
yeah.
even the best of actors
right.
they need to be, you gotta sculpt them in their performance.
Sure.
You know, very rarely do you leave it on just one take. Yeah, there's been moments in cinematic history
sure.
where you just have that one take and it's continuous and you can appreciate for what it is, but you don't have that for a movie throughout unless it's mm-hmm. experimental, like the mm-hmm. 6,100 minute one that's coming out soon with a 72
like
minute trailer.
720 right. hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. Side note.
Talk about having to edit.
No,
yeah.
No, and I think that's where, I mean, because, okay, so we have, you know, currently we have a couple of categories that apes could potentially fall into. Mm-hmm. We have
visual effects
editing.
Yeah, but I don't think they're ever going to give, at least not, I don't see for the foreseeable future that they would
acting.
Ever give an acting nod.
No, but if you give it, say you give it visual effects mm-hmm. to an extent, and you know, we as the fans, mm-hmm. we as the educated fans here, mm-hmm. you know, we can know that can mm-hmm. be as much of a nod to not only Leteri mm-hmm. and company, but to Andy Serkis because mm-hmm. he lends himself to that. You know, it could also be brought, you know, there are 10 categories. Mm-hmm. Maybe it gets thrown in for Best Picture, which mm-hmm. is a testament
to the
achievement
yeah.
of what they've done. And the Academy has done that
and
many of times.
Andy's okay. He's yeah. getting a healthy...
Oh, he has so
yeah.
many projects.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's getting
Andy's
a healthy paycheck for him.
Great
so
paycheck.
Good for him.
And, you know, Andy's
directorial.
Yeah, he's getting a directing. Yeah. So he's gotten a lot from it. But I'm just saying, mm-hmm. like, to Phil's point, if they want to mm-hmm. add a motion capture performance, but I would think that might be going
when that would be a dual like, thing, like the actor and the
would
effects?
It be like motion
yeah.
capture, but then like what
tough.
Do you do for like people
yeah.
who do
animation?
It's very
like
very
straight
in,
like
yeah.
animation. I'd be like,
yeah, and again, it's tough because you know, other than the last animated movie to get nominated. that had, well, no, no, no. Well, Beauty and the Beast got nominated for Best Picture.
And won, right?
Okay. No, it didn't win, but it got nominated. And it was one of the few times that, I mean, Snow White won for Best Picture, but that was such a long time ago. But there was recently a year where we had an animated movie that was nominated both Best Picture, but then they created the Best Animated category, which sort of almost cheapens it, because if a animated movie is good enough to be Best Picture for that year, then it should be nominated for Best Picture of that year.
Yeah.
And if it's good enough to win,
why
do you make another category? But, because they want to give Pixar or Disney and or Fox or DreamWorks
because of the boost it gets.
Right. Exactly. So it's interesting. Will they make another category? I don't know. But I don't want to ever take away from what Andy Serkis and the rest of those actors did. Mm-hmm. Like the person who played Koba. He was really good. As good as
Maurice,
Kirk. Right.
Yeah, Maurice, I mean, there's something about, and just the, and this is such a weird thing to say, but I mean it, the humanity you saw in Maurice.
I agree, though. I mean,
I should say reflected in Maurice, because obviously, you know.
And Judy Greer as Cornelia, who is Caesar's, you know, I mean, all of them brought a personality to the apes where if you saw them, now granted, yes, Koba had the scars and there were physical attributes that, that could help us figure out which ape is which in characterization. But I also think that the actors who were performing the motion capture provided personality.
And they do that with, you know, wardrobe and everything for other actors.
But let's say even Rocker hid the conflict in Rocker about whether or not to kill that human. I mean, Rocker was not on screen for a long time. We didn't have a lot of, but even in that, just that moment, who, and here's a character we don't, haven't really spent a lot of time with. We know what transpired because his son was shot. Right. But just that moment, you were going, wow, that moment of conflict of, well, no, I would, Caesar wouldn't want this. I thought that was captured well and acted well.
Talking about Ash.
Nash was his son that got shot. It was Rocker's son.
Yeah, but I think...
I thought it was Ash that got thrown over...
Ash was the one who got thrown over the balcony. Ash got shot but didn't die.
Yeah, that was Rocker, his dad. His son, Ash, got shot. Rocker was Caesar's third, or roughly.
Roughly.
Ash was his son. So it wasn't Ash that got thrown. It was Rocker that got thrown over.
No, it was Ash.
I thought it was Ash.
Okay.
Ash
I may be wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
But either way, I mean, but the scene works, and it also goes to show, too, the viciousness of Koba. So when it came up to that final scene, you and I were laughing about this because Koba actually had the audacity to say, apes don't kill apes. I'm like, really?
Wow.
But
I understand why he did that, because you know you always want to throw somebody's words in front of them. Like, how true are you to this principle? I mean, I don't have this principle. You do.
Yeah.
So, but and then he did let him go, and it's like, interesting. Yeah, but Caesar, really, you're backing off your own words there, buddy.
Yeah, it'd be
but
like,
that was
just because like
it came
Batman.
To the realization that it's not based on ape or human. It's based on if you're good or bad.
Oh, okay. So it's okay to kill things and
well, if they're bad and he
if
was truly
bad,
evil.
And you're in the middle of the war and if he's trying to kill you.
They don't need that influence.
Maybe.
And plus, trying to kill you. He shot him. you shot
he's
me.
He's claiming self-defense.
You manipulated my son. Oh, and I have to say this, because you talk about not seeing many things that were original, like him going through the fire. You know, I'm tired of the scaffolding fight scenes that take place high atop
a building.
I swear
to God, that reminded me of Donkey Kong when he was there chasing each other. Donkey Kong.
Well, I mean, we've seen it in Amazing Spider-Man. We've seen it in countless other movies where they're atop a building, there's scaffolding falling.
Yeah, but this time the building didn't all the way fall down.
And that was the weird thing. All that C4 and that, it's like, what the hell? That's it?
But I will say that seeing it and watching that scene in 3D and how, and again, we're dealing with apes who could like jump, swing, climb. It was a clever use of your characters and what they're able to do.
Sure, yeah.
And how they would be, like, they're not Spider-Man, so they can't web-sling their way around this. Like, they're actually, like, swinging to certain things, dropping, hanging on. I actually go, okay, you know, I've had it with the scaffolding scenes, but this one's done okay. And this one was interesting to me, I liked how that fight scene took
place. No, I liked a lot of it too, but when the blast happened, I went, what? Why was not the tower being taken down? Well, it was like, oh, a little tremor. That's all that happened. All that C4, and that's all it did.
Big plume. I don't know.
Plume, yeah, exactly.
Phil, what were you going to say?
Well, as we're talking about, we're talking about the comparisons between, humans and apes, and, we've obviously said a lot of our opinion, but did anyone read that article about the two chimpanzees that got
to see the movie?
That saw the movie.
Did you guys hear about this?
No, I don't know anything about it.
A little bit. It was a very small story, but that I saw, and I believe it was in a theater in California. Mm-hmm.
Were they old enough to see this, by the way?
They were 2 years old.
Oh, I don't think this is age appropriate.
They're 2 years old, and there's, I believe, two of them, chimps.
And they sat them in a theater?
And they brought them to a theater, and they had them.
Great, this is the beginning now.
No.
They flung their poo.
Not at all. They loved it. I guess the chimps in general are really big movie fans.
But don't they know that this is the beginning? These apes, these chimps are going to see, we can take over.
It's the beginning
of
Chimpocalypse.
Oh, my God.
Chimpocalypse is...
They were so happy.
I mean, honestly,
if the chimps loved it, and the humans loved it, then it's a hit.
Here's the thing. I think definitely look it up because it's worth, there's little video clips that you can watch now. It's hilarious in the sense that they're enjoying popcorn and drinking soda. So that in itself just shows their personality.
That's
it's
great.
Amazing.
Okay. Did they get charged as an adult or a child?
They did buy tickets.
Well, I know, but did they go to a matinee? They're like, what did they get charged as? Okay.
But, in terms of their actual reactions, one of the chimps was kind of getting into it. The other one was slightly frightened of the images that were, at times on screen. They didn't do like a side-by-side of... I don't think they were allowed to shoot the actual movie.
Uh-huh.
But it would have been interesting to see
what they were being reacted. Yeah.
But overall, they were very engaged in the film.
They were.
But if you think of it, too, like if you took children who weren't 2 years old, like say there were six, seven who were... they sort of understand. They've watched movies at home or maybe even to the big screen, but they may react differently too. Just like two kids could go on a roller coaster and react differently. Mm-hmm. One could say, that was great. The other kid could say, I never want to do that again. Mm-hmm. Like, don't ever take me, So the chimpanzees
having... Maybe one of the
chimps
likes rom-coms.
Yeah, I mean, having different... Well, I think it's a great... I would love to see this video now. I mean, because I think
one of the more... I really loved when, at the armory, he comes in there and...
He's playing the fool?
Yeah, in order to get out of this, he plays the fool, and they're looking at him like, he's playing to them, and he's kind of internally laughing like, you guys think I'm so dumb. I know exactly how you guys want me to be. And then when he shoots them, just the whole theater reacted in such a way of shock.
Yeah.
Because it was so shocking.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was a very well thought out sequence.
It was a great sequence. It played out great.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we know in the audience, oh my God, when is he going to pull that gun? When is he going to just kill these guys? Oh my. And it's not like you don't know
what's
going to happen.
Coming.
Yeah.
But it was done very striking.
They showed that
scene. No hesitation.
Yeah, they showed that scene at CinemaCon. Mm-hmm. When I was at CinemaCon this past year, they showed about 20 minutes of Dawn, and that was one scene that they showed. And it was like everybody in the audience was, as Phil was saying, you're just like, that sense of dread is like, okay, it's coming, and look at him, he's playing, and then when he pulls out the gun. And at this point, you don't know Koba from anybody. You just think, he's playing this, and then,
Those guys were great, too. By the way, I wanted to point that in terms of acting, those guys were great. They played wonderful idiots.
They did. And what were they shooting? Like, they're wasting
shooting
a Humvee. Truck.
What the hell are you doing?
They're testing the ammo.
I know, testing the ammo.
They were unloading so much ammo. Yeah.
They're a little gun happy.
Yeah.
Because we have so much, we can just... Whatever.
Well, since we're talking about chimpanzees, another funny thing that I came across, I dubbed it the bonobo controversy. Now... I will admit my inner, when I was just doing research and I came across this, it says Dawn of the Planet of the Apes defames bonobos. And my thing was, what the hell's a bonobo? I was like, who's it defaming? I go, wow, we are really becoming way too sensitive of a society. But I clicked on it. Mm-hmm. And the relentless march to war. And I read this, and yes, there is a, there is a bonobo conservation initiative. Yeah. For those who do not know what a bonobo
is, it's a type of ape.
It's a type of ape. One of the ones that we're most commonly, that we most commonly see, whether they're brought onto the television talk shows. And they're the ones that, they're 98%, sharing more than 98% of our DNA. So they're the ones that are closest to humans. And basically, they're also the ones that are high on the extinction list. And basically what this,
and they're usually generally very peaceful, so you might like
very, very. Yeah, that's why when
orangutans are typically considered the most peaceful. They are the peaceful man of the jungle. Yeah.
And
I did not get that vibe from Jungle Book.
Oh.
Really?
We want to start some controversy. Look how my mind has been shaped.
As I was reading this article, they were like, you know, Caesar calling out Koba is like, you bonobo, like he said it in a sort of kind of,
I don't remember him doing that, but
yeah, he called, like, they were squaring off and he said something bonobo. Like, you bonobo, or
he
something,
he said it in a derogatory manner,
he said it in a quote unquote derogatory manner. But then as I read the article, they're trying to glom on to it to an extent. I don't think they were finger pointing to Matt Reeves, oh, you ruined everything, like everybody's gonna think bonobos are evil like Koba. You know, so, and then when I read about bonobos, I was like, okay, you know what? We should post this because there is a link if you want to. Apparently, they are on the hit list for extinction because man is actually ruining all of their habitat, their natural habitat.
I think we mean they're on the save list.
Let's they're on the save list. Yes.
They're close to me.
Well, they are. And which is sad. And then, and then when I looked at a picture of what a bonobo is, I was like, oh,
they're adorable.
The ape that I've seen, like countless times. So, in any case, that is the bonobo controversy. Since we were talking about chimpanzees,
Thank you for that. That's good. So people check that out.
So people check it out. I'll supply
the bonobo.
Save the bonobo. So we're doing
That if I try to talk about the different types of apes, I'm going to get them all messed up between monkeys and apes and baboons. I'm just not trying.
Well, but we're doing our good human part. That's right. Gibbons, we don't want chimpocalypse.
Gibbons are great, too.
Yeah.
Gibbons are a lot of fun.
Okay.
What was the monkey that tore that woman's face off?
Okay, let's move on to what else?
We should talk about music.
All right, music. Let's get into it.
Michael Giacchino. Who I'm actually going to see next week at a quote-unquote Star Trek concert. But Michael Giacchino, who's worked with J.J. Abrams, he's done Lost, he's worked with Matt Reeves and such, a really, really big Planet of the Apes fan. He had Planet of the Apes figures in his office. So
I think that this is particularly interesting because if I remember the 68 one, the music they had in that was very interesting. And
very interesting.
And
Jerry Goldsmith.
Absolutely. It was a fabulous, widely respected, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And for good reason, by the way. But I remember that music being very off-putting, and you felt like you were in a different world, which obviously was the reason for it, and it was wonderful. And this one, they had similar ideas of that, not quite as striking. As I remember, even the music that Phil played at the beginning of our podcast here was, you could feel that otherworldliness to it and stuff. So that part was very effective for me. But other than that, you guys go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, and to your point though, Giacchino himself, music, 6 days to record 115 minutes of music with an orchestra of 89 and a choir of 70, including some of the most sophisticated sounds. That created by the composer. Now, he won the Academy Award for Up, so he's worked with Pixar. And he too, there's a famous shot, there's a famous photograph of Jerry Goldsmith conducting the orchestra in an ape's mask. And he showed up in an ape's mask.
That's great.
But another tie-in is one of his eight percussionists is an 81-year-old Emil Richards
played. He's an ape percussionist?
81.
Eight. I'm sorry.
It sounded like you said one of his ape. So he actually used apes?
Yes, that's the only way.
Go to the jungle.
That would be cool.
My apologies.
Okay, go ahead.
Eight, the number after seven, before nine. Percussionist was a link to the Goldsmith Classic.
Oh, nice.
81-year-old Emil Richards, who played in the 1968 original and at least other three other Apes films. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. Yeah, yeah. And he did want to take from Jerry Goldsmith. Yeah. He used the Taiko drums, the ank lungs, the log drums. He wanted to make it a little off-putting. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a different world. Yeah. And I think he succeeded generally. Yeah. I think, you know, he's
I think so too, because the thing that stuck out to me most about this soundtrack was the percussion. And it really, at certain points, there was no hold bars on volume or on.
Yeah.
He just built it with those drums and the pounding. And I was like, this is either a war cry or like heart pounding, but it was enticing. And I did take the percussion element very much stayed with me throughout the film.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and he uses a choir very good. So, Gene Kino, again, another one of those, you know, we had John Ottman here. I think he and John Ottman, you know, we talk about Desplat a lot. Mm-hmm. But those two gentlemen, what they're able to do with music, and, you know, I think that, we have this little guy called John Williams. You know, we talk about Jerry Goldsmith and such, and, you know, but John Williams has made such iconic scores as did Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of people, their go-to are, you know, when you hear John Williams in just any sense, whether you're a movie lover, people know who he is. Mm-hmm. You know, and I look at people like Ottman and Gene Kino as being heir apparents because they make themes. They do these great things. So, you know, and I love how he throws back to Jerry Goldsmith. And again, it's another one of those tie-ins we talked about at the top of the show where keep the threads going, you know. And it's a great – don't dish your past or turn your back on the past unless it's the Tim Burton one. You know, that'll probably be the only mention of that movie because we haven't mentioned it at all. But yeah,
Tim Roth had fun in that movie.
He did have fun in that movie.
I liked him in that movie. Yeah, was fun at that.
We could do a whole show in that movie because apparently that wasn't again the studio. But yeah,
I wanted to talk. I mean, I know we were talking about music, but you were just talking about threads, and we were talking about. I also thought the production design, like for instance, when we were seeing the Caesar's village and his house and all. And then also when Malcolm was going to them and he had to go through the archway, all those weird spikes and, you know,
trees.
Very reminiscent of the first one with the X's on the, what territory? I forgot what it was called. The Forbidden Territory.
The Forbidden Zone.
Zone. For me, those were those threads coming through as well.
Sure.
So I thought that was very, reminiscent, shall we say.
Yeah, no, I agree. While you were watching, so the opening scene. Mm-hmm. You saw the spikes in the trees, and I'm like going, that took a hell of a lot of time to do. So 10 years makes sense because you're only going to do that in 10 years put all these like climbing, but it made so much sense.
Yeah.
And I did love the way that the village looked. However, again, going back to your thing of originality, I was at some point expecting an Ewok to pop out somewhere.
Yeah, there was a little bit,
but how can you, you know, when you're in
it's hard not to when you're in the
trees. It's hard not to, something else of
I'm
pop
sure
culture.
I'm sure they were aware of it to some degree. I'm like, okay, let's make sure it's not like that. But but there were.
It's hard not to.
I had the same kind of feeling when it was
it's hard not to. Because they had the fires going on. Mm-hmm. But again, the sense of community that they had, and again, it only works like if you're drawn in. I bought it.
Yeah,
I bought it.
I did like the production design of that, and I liked the big distinctions between where the apes lived, where the humans lived, and all that other stuff. I thought that was done well. And the ivy, the vine covered walls, and all that. Although they weren't really exact replicas of the buildings that they were purporting to be in San Francisco, but reminiscent enough, I guess.
On location.
That's true.
There was one other scene
I recognize.
Was I the only one? I think it was in the. There were actually two. When the apes were chained in the bus.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What little I know about apes, is that they are 20 times the strength, if not more than humans. And I'm like going, that's not going to hold. Like, all I have to do is this.
I know, and I'm going, I think the apes who locked them up would have known that. You know, so it seems ridiculous. The only thing I could think of is I go, okay, so these are, in their minds, pacifists anyway, so they're not really going to say, what? Right. No, they would not have locked them up like this.
It's just a weird, very strange... In that same scene, there was a scene that had, like, razor wire.
Yeah.
And I noticed people
were flying over it?
Yeah, I'm like going, those extras, not... Yeah, no, there's a reason why it's called razor wire. Not so that you can grab it as something to lift yourself up on. It was in the background.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I thought too, and I was like,
that's razor wire. It's not like barbed wire. That's razor wire.
Like, you can't do that.
Yeah, not with your bare hands.
I guess they were so desperate that they flipped the bus.
Yeah. I'll give it that.
You liked when they flipped it?
When they flipped it onto them.
Did you have a favorite scene? Anybody have a favorite scene in the movie? Phil?
I'd have to think about it.
Yeah. I there isn't one that stands out to me. Although I have to say, just acting-wise, I already mentioned I like the Malcolm Caesar scene at the end. I thought that was done well.
Yeah.
So.
I think it was Phil or someone mentioned it, the moments when Caesar really claimed his power, especially when it was contrast to you have, you know, Dreyfus blowing this megaphone. Crying everybody, and then you get Caesar who literally just, like, makes a hand motion or says one thing, and like the stillness and the power. I loved all of those moments for him.
Right. We should mention,
and that was interesting because later on when he's at his own home. I loved that he went to his old home, which is from Rise, which you didn't see, but you got it was his old home.
And it makes sense.
But when he's in his own home and he's talking to his son, and he's talking about you need to come back, whatever it is, and he goes, no, they'll see me as weak. In contrast to what you were saying about how he just commands their attention, and you know, in that world, if I'm weak, I won't have their attention.
Right. Now they say. Because a big question has been, why is James Franco? What happened to James Franco's character?
Right,
he died.
Yeah,
they didn't say that.
I know, but inferred that he was not genetically immune to the disease.
Yeah, and apparently there was an X on his door. So because I didn't know. Well, I mean, I guess he was approached to be in it, but you know,
he wasn't.
He had no idea.
As soon as Max Wyatt was, I'm sorry, not Max. I beg your pardon. Rupert was replaced. He had said that now that Rupert's not a part of it, I don't think I'm going to be in it, and no one's ever talked to me about it. Yeah. So we
should talk a little bit about like the book. I mean, I know we made mention of it, but we should the graphic novel was. Right. It's The Black Hole.
Which is about teenagers being ostracized.
Right, and the story is about sexually transmitted disease among American teenagers. Yep. So, very similar to Ape's narrative. So it makes sense that he gives it to Maurice, you know. And what I loved about it was that it was a graphic novel. Because when you look at the form, the shape of... when you look at the comic form, it is graphic. It's a picture. It's something that the ape could understand. It wasn't just the written word. So to me, that he hands him a graphic novel, I was like, well, that makes sense. That's something that Maurice could potentially understand and communicate and maybe even learn from. I love that it was a graphic novel because he could have handed him Shakespeare and he could have, just put my cup on top of it.
He was like, you could tell they were just like learning with the alphabet. Like they had him drawing like the A's. And like, I agree that it was a picture.
Yeah, I think that it was a graphic novel. I thought that's a nice touch because that's something that he'll have much more of a concept of trying to get through.
Yeah.
So, but my favorite scene, as I said before, I really did love the tank scene. I thought that was the way that was choreographed and done. And with everything put in and the way it was filmed, I thought, wow, I sort of likened it to the Quicksilver scene in X-Men. Although that scene was, that's the best scene this summer. The Quicksilver.
When he's running around.
That one to me, you know, but this one was close.
I don't know why you said Quicksilver on with the Silver Surfer, and I went, Silver Surfer and X-Men, huh? Thank you. Anyway, that's where I went.
I apologize for the confusion. Phil, do you have a favorite scene? Is he back?
No.
Is he there?
That's right, moving on.
Okay.
So, okay, did you say one? I can't remember. Yeah. Sarah, did you have one?
Yeah.
Favorite scene?
What was yours?
Well, I think that I don't know if I had an actual singular scene. I think for me, it's just like a lot of like different images pop to my head throughout the film, which to me makes me happy. I think I was new to this world. I think I got a very good introduction to it that I'm very happy with.
You may not. You might. You may not. What do you think you'll see? Just see the original. Maybe, maybe not.
You know, you could
get away
with
it. Comes on TV every once in a while. You can see
it. It's on, yeah, they play it on TCM occasionally. Stream and it's
it. I think the one that at the moment I'm most curious about would probably be Rise. Yes. And you guys have talked about the first one a lot, so I would. But overall, you guys didn't make the whole thing sound too happy.
No, it's not. It's not at all.
No.
It is not a feel-good movie of the year at all.
No, but I mean, I would say...
But neither is this one. It ends like this one. I was like, oh, man, there's impending doom coming.
I did like this one better than Rise.
There are things I liked about this one better than Rise, and things about Rise I like better than this one.
Interesting.
There you go.
Yeah, I will be interested if, in fact, they do come out with an extended version of this. Because maybe we will get more of the Gary Oldman character. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get to see a hint of what the original ending was. But I would be curious. I had no inclination of getting Rise of the Planet of the Apes when it had come out. But this one, like I said, I walked out of this one going, wow, they really upped their game. And for a sequel... Yeah. I think they did a good
and
job.
They're getting great reviews. It's good.
Everyone seems to
Everybody's
love it.
Everybody's liking this. Well, what is it?
That's one of the reasons that I also would have seen this.
Rotten Tomatoes is 91 critics, 93 audience, something like that.
People are raving.
Yeah, 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. CinemaScore got an A-, which is really good. The production budget alone, 170 for production alone. I guess with print and advertising or hard drives and advertising, $225 million.
It's $73 million. It's weekend,
yeah,
72.6.
Is that
domestically or is that
domestic?
Yeah.
Total date domestic gross. It surpassed 100 million already, so it's 100 plus. Worldwide gross is 130 plus. So we're talking close to 140 worldwide. So you know the world is accepting of the apes. Remember that, chimps. We're liking this movie, so no chimpocalypse. You know, we there
don't
are
come after us.
Don't come after us.
If we lose power, you're gonna just beat us because apparently
you beat us with hard drives.
Exactly.
And it was number one at the box office. More than likely, it'll be number one. It'll
be
the
what
second
else
movie.
What can top it?
Nothing really.
There's nothing challenging.
Yeah, it'll more likely be the second movie this summer to be number one for more than. One week.
Yeah.
I mean, kudos. Fox did a great job. You mentioned the marketing. I felt that the marketing on this movie was even better than Rise. Like, they really did. Well, you know what they did? Matt Reeves even says this too. I was happy to see apes on horses. Apes on horses.
Why?
I mean, that,
I have to say, every once in a while, I'd see that and I go, "God, that just looks weird."
Because that's from the original.
Oh, no, I know.
And
I
like,
should.
That's
one
of the things that. Well, it's one of the things that's offsetting. Like when Charlton Heston first, when you see when he recognizes what threw a net over him, it's an ape on a horse. And even in the television show, there were apes on horses. We didn't have that in Rise. In this one, they're apes on horses.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That was.
It was a
deal.
Great poster too. Like I like
the war paint.
I just looked at every time I saw one. I was like, "That just doesn't. That looks weird." Big, tall, long-bodied ape on a horse.
I don't know.
And I always thought, "Yeah, I don't know that I'd ever. I never really fully bought that apes would somehow tame horses."
I don't know. It was in the first.
Yeah.
Next.
I feel like apes would be better at taming horses.
They could be. Horse whisperers.
I don't see why they. I never bought that they would ever have the reason to. Because why would they need them?
Well, next, so I want to see apes in pleather. That's going back to the original.
So they have the full on costumes.
Apes in pleather. Yeah. But no, apes on horses. In that last poster that they released, Fox released. With the ape on the horse with his gun, and the bridge behind him. I know that you didn't like, but I thought their marketing was great for this movie.
The only marketing I ever saw was that one poster. I didn't see any trailers.
You didn't see the eyes? There were so many, of the eyes and the war paint.
Yeah.
Like, that would be the image I
remember. I think that was like
anything
the
like that.
Teachers.
I assume that was at billboards. I don't know.
Billboards, trailers, posters.
I specifically, I ban all of it when I know I'm going to be watching a movie. So
well, let me ask you, how do you do that when, all right, beginning of the summer, you see Godzilla.
Yeah.
Do you go in after the trailers or do you just sort of kind of
pay attention
to your popcorn?
Yeah, I don't pay attention to the trailers. And there are many times where I specifically leave when the trailers are happening. and oh, and then I'll come back and sit down.
Interesting.
I just don't want to be
that's crazy
in any way told what the movie is or what it's about. I want it to be well, you know, Phil, just we were talking beforehand the whole thing about the Grand Canyon, you can't really fully experience it if you know about it. Sure. I just want to sit down and have the movie happen. I don't want to know ahead of time how you do that.
Ever since I was a kid, I was like the previous, and then when I learned about the trailer business, my first job, exhibitor relations at Universal in 1990, and oh my god, then trailers became my life in a sense.
And, oh, I know. I used to love watching trailers. I used to go to the movies, and I wanted to go early because I wanted to see all the trailers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But many years now, I've decided no, I don't want to know anything. It's so enjoyable to have the movie just to happen. So, you know, for instance, that specific reason I told you.
How do you know what to see or what not to see then?
Well, usually I kind of know what I might be interested in.
Okay.
Or that I might go see. But for that specific reason, which I mentioned earlier, which is I saw the poster, I saw the Golden Gate, and I'm going, when it doesn't happen, I go, what? That just ticks me off, and it ruins the experience for me. Because you put that in my head, and then I don't want to be a bait and switch.
But here's the thing. It can work against you on a movie like Under the Skin.
No.
That's true.
It can. It just can.
Absolutely.
And when they put
I don't know if anything would
trailer.
Have saved that one for me.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, as far as Dawn of the Planet of the Apes goes, I do think that Fox did a good job. It was nice in doing my research that the executives heeded to certain things and that they actually listen, because that doesn't happen all the time. Mm-hmm. I do think the story is funny about don't confuse yourself with Avatar when it comes to subtitles. But I'm glad that Matt Reeves won the battles that he wanted to win to make the movie that he put forth. And he is slated to direct the third one.
Yeah.
He is going to go on. I guess his next dream project is The Invisible Woman. Which would be interesting, but I would listen.
Didn't that movie?
Loved,
sorry, there was ahead. I think another movie that just came out called The Invisible Woman, and I got so
there was an Invisible Man.
I believe an Invisible Woman that just
I don't
came.
Recall, but
I didn't see it.
No, it's a totally I think different genre than what you're talking about.
Yeah, but Matt Reeves, Cloverfield, I really enjoyed.
Hated it.
Did you really
hated
see,
it?
I really enjoyed Cloverfield and Let Me In. I thought was a
bored
great,
the crap out of me.
Wow,
I'm wanting to leave.
Wow, really?
I thought
I was going to hate it because I'm not a big
first person shaky cam, whatever.
Yeah, shaky cam.
Yeah.
But I thought he did a really good job.
Was just annoyed. It was like this dull, boring.
Yeah, I thought he made it look good. I thought, you know, to me,
What was the next one you were talking about?
Let Me In, which is a remake of the Swedish horror vampire.
Yeah, no,
To me, Let the Right One In is a fantastic, great horror movie, and you know, to redo it to bring it into the States, it's a lot of gumption because there's a lot of good cred to that movie, and I thought he did a very good job. And again, I think he has a good vision. You're friends with J.J. Abrams, you pal about together, you do certain things, you pick certain things up. I think that again, he's one of these young. We have a good crop of directors to guide our future for movies, and he's. I think he's in that. That I think he's in that field, so I always look forward to what he has coming up next.
Not, I don't know. My jury's still out for me. It's like, so I don't know.
We will have to see that.
Yeah. What did you? What camp are you in, or where do you fall on the?
I'm probably in
Rupert
the
Wise scale. I'm sorry, Matt Reeves.
I don't think I'm. Like the thing is, I really like this movie, so right now I'm on his side, and like I'm excited to turn to the next one. I mean, but you never really know. I didn't have the extreme hatred that you did.
I didn't really put it all together because I didn't even know before I saw it who directed the movie.
Sure. Mm.
Didn't even know that.
Wow.
I didn't know that. And so, and it was only afterwards when I was preparing for this, I went, oh, shoot, that's, and it, one of the things that bothered me about Cloverfield was that it's like, yeah, okay, a lot of things I've already seen. And this one, that was the part that bugged me. Was that there were obvious choices and things I've seen before, and I went, this does not break ground for me. And so, and what that's the thing I'm worried about the next one. I was like, please, if you're going to go this route, I think
my kind of rule of thumb on that is that if they at least surprise me with one fact, like one big thing, then I'm willing to forgive them for repeats.
Interesting.
Like, I think that. I mean, there's just so many films out there. There's so many people that people look up to. There's so many things that have been done. And so if they are pushing the envelope a little bit or bringing something new or something I haven't seen before, then I'm willing to kind of be like, but look, that's
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was plenty that I liked about it. There was just too much of it that, for me, that was like...
Okay. Phil, how about you? Any thoughts on Matt Reeves?
I'm indifferent. I mean, to that extent, it takes a very strong director for me to kind of really recognize him. I mean, we're talking Christopher Nolan type level, Steven Spielberg, unfortunately Michael Bay. But you know, he's not a bad. No, here's the thing, Dawn. You know, as we're talking about Dawn, I absolutely love Dawn.
Yeah.
I would care recommend for Cloverfield? This. I don't know. You know, his body of work is not there yet for me, where I can say, like, oh, it's fantastic.
And I try to look at it as I see his body of work progressing. Like, you know, we can mention Spielberg. And Spielberg, listen, 1975, or even if you want to put in Sugarland Express and such, he's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And I hope... I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but yeah, I want him to continue on. Mm-hmm. But we need that torch passed, and I always try to look at directors who instill something
up and coming,
grab something out of me that I remember, like looking in, growing up in the '70s, the '80s, like that pulled me into that great.
Here's the only problem when you watch this. I mean, not that I disagree. I 100% agree with you in that respect, but with this. You know, I think you could put any kind of director and say, oh, they directed it. Whereas Steven Spielberg, he is so intrinsically his own. Quentin Tarantino, for better or worse, you know that's his movie. Robert Rodriguez, even Michael Bay. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You just know that is a Michael Bay movie.
But this,
I don't, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that he can't get there. But that's what I want to see. If you're making that point, that's what I want to see. A movie that didn't really put a stamp on it.
But sometimes I don't like it when directors.
Yeah, but even Spielberg.
You need people with stamps, and you need people who, you know, can bounce around. Kind of.
You couldn't say that in 1975 to 1977, 78 when Spielberg came out with Close Encounters, which was such a different movie from Jaws. I mean, it took time for Spielberg to get.
Or body of work.
It would take time for anybody else.
And it could take time, but now, you know, when we're looking at people like J.J. Abrams, when we're looking at people like Joss Whedon, when we look at people like Matt Reeves, I'm comfortable that, like, you can sort of see that kind of progression. I'm omitting a bunch of other directors that I appreciate, like Alfonso Cuarón, and you mentioned Quentin Tarantino, who has a stamp. But I think for a young crop of directors who were brought up in the same kind of movies that I was brought up in, and they want to try to instill that entertainment value, there's a reason why J.J. Abrams was picked to do Star Wars. There's a reason why for that. And why Joss Whedon works so well in doing these comic book big movies, but he can do a small Shakespearean movie. So I always look at, like, I look at a Matt Reeves going, you know, he could potentially be that torchbearer to go into the future and make those entertaining kind of movies. I see the potential in him. He's only done 3 movies, but I will look forward to his upcoming movies. That's me. I'm a fan. So,
no, I really, I don't go to movies because of who directed it. That's just me. It's not like I go, oh, I'll see anything he makes. I just don't do that.
Yeah.
There you go.
So.
Except if I direct it, but
except for Phil. Phil directed it, I'm there.
We would all be there.
Absolutely.
All of us. Absolutely. So.
And if Sarah was in it, I'm there.
I'm there. All of us.
So. All right, last words. Last words, we gotta get out of here.
I think I've had my last words. I've bored everybody enough.
I feel like I've said everything I need to say to
you. Oh, there you go. Then that's a good timing there. Phil, what about you?
Regardless of whether or not I think Matt Reeves is an auteur, not yet. I love Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I'm really, you know, I know Dimitri and I talked about where the sequel to the Planet of the Apes was not what Planet of the Apes was, and I'm really glad. Yes, there's going to be debate. Was Rise better than Dawn or Dawn better than Rise? Yeah. Regardless, they're both really good. And so if we get another third movie that's good, and maybe a fourth and a fifth, and
let's reboot the franchise. And absolutely. I can say, go see this. I think it's a good movie. You'll enjoy yourself, regardless of whatever. You know. But part of what we do here is we nitpick like crazy. That's what that's what this thing's designed to do.
Like we're walking through razor wire.
That's right. We want every movie to be amazing in every aspect.
We try. We try.
All right. On that note, we want to thank you very much for listening. We'll tune in next time. We'll talk to you later.
Bye, Bright Eyes.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.